Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 86-year-old John D. Hosey of Woodinville, Washington. Originally from Alabama, he served in the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and beyond. 29 years total, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. Some of his most intense experiences came as a helicopter pilot with the 282nd Aviation Company during the Vietnam War. You told us about some of the hairiest missions you had, but do you have a count of how many missions you flew over there?
Oh, jeepers. That's a good question. I don't know that I ever got a count of that. I've been asked how many hours that I've flown in combat, and I can only tell you that I don't know. I know that I flew almost every day, and once we reached 100 hours in a month, we were supposed to take 2 days off, and then we could fly again. That was our rule. I know that I cheated on those rules every now and then, so I guess if you said 12 times 100, that would give you pretty close to what I have flown. Or you could figure it out maybe another way. I got 25 air medals, so an air medal took 25 hours of combat, or 50 hours, I think it was, of flying in a combat zone. I'd say at least 95% of mine were probably under combat conditions, so that might give you a pretty good idea, too.
Well, another thing that a lot of people have counted, a lot of the World War II flyers and the fixed-wing stuff, will talk about a count of bullet holes in the aircraft, and I have to imagine you guys did that once or twice with your helicopter.
Yeah, the mission that I just told you about, my maintenance officer told me that he counted 187 holes throughout the chopper. Now, that was in and out, so who knows how many went through the door. But the strange part of it was that both pilots got hit, but neither one of my door gunners got touched. And we thanked the old man upstairs for their protection because they protected us. That was another one. And the MACV team sent me a note telling me that they were grateful for what I did and everything, and that they were putting me in for an award. And I found out later that they had put their captain in for the DSC, and it had been downgraded to a Silver Star. So my group didn't even put me in. It was written up as a DSC, but they changed it when they heard he got the Silver Star. They changed mine to the Silver Star. But Paul, I didn't do what I did for medals. I did what I did because, number one, it was a job that had to be done. When we came back from Vietnam, we were called baby killers. We were called, you know, all kinds of names. We were spit upon, and just you wondered why you did what you did at the time. But if I know that politics got us out of Vietnam. If they had left us alone, maybe we would have given that country what we gave Korea, but they didn't.
Before I forget, I mean, I'm looking at your shadow box up here, and there's a medal from the Vietnamese government. There's the American Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Distinguished Flying Cross. The Air Medal doesn't have room for all the clusters because you mentioned 25 of those. Three Purple Hearts, and we've heard about two Purple Hearts. And that's not to mention the CIB, the Combat Infantry Badge, plus your paratrooper wings and your pilot's wings. That's a pretty crowded shadow box you got going there. But with the Purple Heart, we've heard about you being wounded in Korea, the bayonet through the arm. We heard about this mission. You're flying the helicopter. You're shot through the leg. Would have been shot higher on the leg if not for your camera in that spot, saving everybody's life aboard the chopper. What about the third Purple Heart?
Well, it was, I guess, the least of all, and I hardly ever mention it, but I took 13 stitches across my forehead from shrapnel. It was the metal off of the airplane from where one, bullet discharged that metal, and it put a strip across my forehead. And I think it was either 12 or 13 stitches. And the funny part there was the Marine that was sewing me up, after he cleaned it up and he started to sew me up, he was having trouble getting a needle through my thick skull up there. And after about the third stitch, I gritted my teeth and I said, "Damn, Captain, don't you have a duller needle you can use?" And he told me, he says, "Captain, you're lucky I've even got a needle to sew you up with." So after I got back on my feet and everything, I went to the hospital and got him a bunch of stuff and took him over and dropped it off at his hospital for him. They were all happy with that. But I wanted him to have at least some stitching needles. The one that looks like the fish hook?
Yeah.
That's the one. And I wanted him to have some of those for the next guy that he had to sew up.
Well, and, you know, the question comes to mind, too. So you said you rarely talk about it. It's no big deal. But a piece of shrapnel comes into your forehead. That's another one. I mean, that's a couple inches away from your eye. I mean, that could do a lot of damage to a lot of things. Could it killed you if it was placed right? What were the circumstances at the time? Where were you flying?
We were evacuating people out of Wayside. I must have had, I know I was overloaded. And I figured for landing, I would have a lot of my fuel gone, so I wouldn't, no sweat. But you could probably put 2, 3, 4 Vietnamese forever American on your chopper if you had the room for him. That was the difference in the weight and all. And coming out of Wayside, we lost our engine and took around, and we went into the South China Sea. I lost 3 people from drowning. I lost 1 Vietnamese kid. I lost 1 American who was a newspaper reporter. Then I lost 1 GI. The GI froze, and he wrapped his arms around the post in the helicopter, and that's where they found him. He was still had his arms wrapped around that post in the helicopter. He never let go so he could go to the surface and swim to shore, and that's where they found him. So he just froze right there. But he wasn't the only one that froze. When we started having troubles, my co-pilot, he froze whenever I told him to put out a mayday. And to wake him up, I had to slap him upside the head, and then he put out a mayday for us. But he turned out to be a great pilot overall. And all of us have our problems at times of freezing. It doesn't matter if you're driving a car or whatever you're doing. There's times when we freeze for a few seconds and we don't even realize it unless we get run off the road or run into a tree or something. Then we realize, hey, we could have avoided that, but we froze for a second. So you don't downgrade anybody, especially in combat. I have learned in combat conditions for freezing for a few seconds. Our biggest heroes have been, I don't really want to call them cowards to start, but they wound up being heroes. So you never know what you're capable of until you have to do it. And that was the thing. If you had told me that I would do what I did at 16 years old, I would have probably laughed at you and told you, hey, no way, I'm a bigger coward than that. You're not going to get me to do that. And then if after the Korean War, if you had told me what I'd be doing as a chopper pilot, I would have laughed at you again and said, you're crazy, man. So I don't laugh or downgrade anybody for doing some of the things that they do under combat conditions.
I've got a few more questions for you. I sure appreciate all your time and willingness to share, and I don't want to pry on that situation, but as I hear you describe that mission, I mean, you're nicked in the head, so you're bleeding. The aircraft is no longer cooperating. You're not going to make it to where you're going, and you ended up going into the water. And you told me about the 3 people who perished, but what about you? What did you have to do to survive once you hit the water?
You know, I honestly believe, Paul, it was the old man upstairs that, can you see that poster right there? See that Indian up above, that soldier?
Yeah.
The artist gave me this. He said he couldn't sign it because if he signed it, I had to pay for it. So David gave it to me, and he says, there is your angel. He says, you're part Cherokee. There is your angel. He will guard you, and he'll take care of you if you believe it. We had been trained only on blackboard, more or less, or through just talking, how to ditch a chopper in the water. You never turn a chopper to the left. You always try to turn it to the right once you're on the water. When I got close to the water, I did exactly what I had been taught, because it all came back to me in my head. About 6 feet away from the water, I started to pull my collective and started slowing the chopper down. When I hit the water, I took and I turned it onto its right side. That takes the chopper blade into the water. On the left, the chopper blade comes into the helicopter. But if you turn it to the right, the chopper blade turns into the water, collapses on itself in the water. So I did exactly what I'd been taught. On the helicopters, there are a steel plate on the left and the right of the pilots. So if they're being shot at from the side, that plate deflects the bullet. The plate comes up just about like this and protects this. The only way that that plate can be moved is if the door gunner or the crew chief pulls the pin and slides it back, okay? When we hit the water, there was no way for our crew chiefs to do that. My guardian angel, I believe, all the way across the back and over the pilot's head is two rows of rivets in that helicopter. That helicopter split open like a can of sardines, and we went up through where the helicopter split open. And that's how we got out of that helicopter, both of us. That's how both pilots got saved. And I've got pictures of that. I don't know if you saw that in my book, but I got pictures of that, and I can show you. But we had about, 100 yards from the beach, because I'd turned back to the beach hoping to make it to the beach. We went in, and one Vietnamese kid died. I grabbed one Vietnamese boy and towed him to shore, and I couldn't do any more. But when we got to the shore, help started to arrive for us, and they started helping drag us out of the water and take care of who was hurt and that kind of stuff. So that one was just, overall freak of combat, too much time on the bird or something. But they got the bird out of the water, and they checked it out and all, and they came up with that the automatic fuel governor had cut out on me and died. The first time it just cut out, and then whenever I got the engine back, I put too much power back into it, and it cut out again, and that time I didn't ever got it back.
But aren't we thankful we got John Hosey back? I know his wife Sandy is. It's break time again, but we're not quite done yet. We'll get some final thoughts from this decorated veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org. And you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.